Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 12th of August. We talk about the three-day music festival that took place 40 years ago this weekend, Woodstock. Richie Havens in a song that was pretty much improvised, the first performer of the three-day festival, and there was much going on during those 3 days. Our guests have written a book that's filled with extraordinary pictures and great stories about Woodstock, what led to Woodstock, what was happening during the decades of the 60s, the people who attended Woodstock, facts and figures about this three-day music festival, the musicians who came to perform, and those who we think came to perform but actually weren't there to perform. Our guests are the authors of Woodstock, 3 days that rocked the world. Mike Evans is one of the authors, a musician on the 60s rock scene who began writing about popular music in the 1970s. Since the 80s, he's worked in book publishing, commissioning, and editing titles on rock and roll, jazz, and popular culture. And Mike, we thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for being here. Paul Kingsbury is also with us. Paul is a writer and editor specializing in music and the environment, the author or co-author of several books, and served as a consulting editor to the Billboard Illustrated Encyclopedia of Music. And we thank you so much, Paul, for being with us. Hello.
Hey, great to be with you.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Let's start. We're going to play a little music during the course of the hour, but let's start with what was going on during the decade of the 60s that was all a part of this musical explosion that took place. It was a wild decade. There were assassinations, the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, the women's movement was starting. Did we need all of those in order to have a Woodstock?
I think the combination of those sort of social factors combined with this very strong youth movement that was tied together by music was a very explosive sort of thing, that something like this was bound to happen by the end of the 60s.
Paul, what do you think?
Oh, I totally agree with Mike, of course. You know, Woodstock was a fabulous music festival, but it was so much more of that. In a lot of ways, it was the zenith of the counterculture movement in the United States.
Martin Scorsese, who filmed the event, and maybe if he hadn't done that, we wouldn't remember it as much 40 years later, called this a transcendent moment in his life to be there. He had problems with what was going on, but it really deeply affected him. Do you think that happened to a lot of people, or was it just 3 days of taking quite a few drugs and having a good time and listening to music? Or was it transcendent in some way? And if so, what way?
Well, a lot of people that we talked to, they went to the festival either as musicians or as fans, to a degree expecting another music festival. Certainly the musicians did. It was just a date in the diary, you know, a gig. But when they got there, and by the end of the 3 days, it did transform people in the sense that they were astounded by what they saw in terms of not just the huge volume of people, but the whole way that under great sort of stress and extreme circumstances, what with the weather and the under catering for half a million people, that they pulled through by sort of self-help and communal kind of spirit, which nobody anticipated. It was far bigger than the organizers anticipated, and far more important, I think, in social terms than anybody anticipated. And so when they came away from it, even though they might have had a bit of a nightmare of a time, they came away, I think, realizing that there'd been something special that occurred.
Mm-hmm. And what was it special that occurred, Paul?
Well, as Mike was alluding to, the fact that they were all up against it. You know, the promoters had expected maybe 100 to 150,000 people, and they had probably three times that many people
right.
who were there.
Yeah.
And the people who came really weren't prepared. The promoters weren't prepared for the mass of humanity, the almost constant rains. I mean, rains came on and off throughout the weekend. But fortunately, as Mike has said, there was that communal spirit. I mean, it was really the counterculture at its best, in which you had people like Wavy Gravy and the Hog Farmers Commune setting the tone, sharing free food. Certainly the fans, that we were in touch with said, it was a sense of, we were all going to pull through together, instead of fighting for a scrap of ground. People would look after other people's plates. They would make sure there was enough food to go around. And, that was Woodstock. It was, counterculture at its best.
You may as well tell the story, because a significant portion of the audience was not alive during those years. I certainly was. But what in the world was the Hog Farmers Commune?
Yeah, the Hog Farmers Commune, excuse me, there's a phone ringing. I can't.
I know. You can't turn it off.
Am I going to take that, or is that mine now?
Hang on a minute. It's okay. The Hog Farmers Commune was a group of hippies, if you like, who lived down in New Mexico. And Michael Lang, the organizer, had heard about them, and he'd contacted them to persuade them and flown them up by jet to actually take care of aspects of the security and the kind of what became the sort of self-help. And as Paul said, when the actual festival developed and some of the chaos started to develop, they were the ones who fed the masses, if you like, and also the ones who organized a lot of informal security. They had a thing called the police force, their security. So it was the idea that you said, please don't do that, and so on. So they were a great influence. They epitomized the best of that hippie peace and love kind of counterculture.
I love that phrase. It's the police force. That's something. Was it, in terms of music, it's been called the greatest gathering of popular musicians ever. Do you think that's true, Mike?
Well, that's probably a slight exaggeration, because there were gatherings during that period of similar assemblages of musicians at the Monterey Pop and the Miami Pop Festival and various other events. I think what made Woodstock unique wasn't just the cross-section of musicians, even though that was incredible, but the all those other circumstances that made it very special.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the people who weren't there. I wasn't at Woodstock, but you would think, and I thought actually, that people like Joni Mitchell was there. Her story is interesting. People would think that Bob Dylan was there, as a matter of fact, and he wasn't there as well.
Well, the interesting thing about Bob Dylan is that he lived in Woodstock itself. As you know, the festival took place about 40 miles south, the actual festival. But he lived in Woodstock itself, and there was a great sort of anticipation that he would eventually appear. The rumor spread around that he was definitely going to appear, and he didn't, and then he didn't, and then he didn't, and the band, his sort of backing group, they appeared. If truth were known, on the day the festival opened, he was already on the Queen Elizabeth II sailing for England to do the Isle of Wight Festival 2 weeks later. But
Dylan did not want to be a part of that kind of thing in his own backyard. As we quote him in the book, he said, Woodstock, I did not want to be a part of that thing. I liked the town, but I felt they exploited it, going up there and getting, he exaggerates, 15 million people all in the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
That don't excite me. They wanted Dylan there. He wasn't willing to be there, but certainly it was a fantastic lineup that they did get, and they got a lot of them at bargain prices.
Yeah. Tell me about the history of the area, which you explore in the book. There were a lot of artists during the 20th century who lived in that community, and a lot of musicians had done smaller, obviously much smaller, gatherings in Woodstock. It was a place of cultural expression for a long time prior to Woodstock.
Yes, it was an artistic center from the beginning of the 20th century. In fact, the house that Bob Dylan occupied from the mid-60s was an old arts and crafts building, which went back to that period at the beginning of the century. And it had always been considered a kind of a sort of rural Greenwich Village, I suppose, a kind of sort of an artistic community. And then in the 60s, with Bob Dylan and various other people settling there, it started to become a sense of sort of rock music or popular music. And hence the reason that, one of the reasons why it originally was going to locate there, the festival.
Mm-hmm. And tell me the story of how they found Max Yasgur. It's quite a story. They had deals with other people, and then people realized what might be happening, and they backed out of the deal. He's an amazing character in all of this, isn't he?
Yeah. Paul, do you want to talk about Max?
How they got to Max, because, you know, when they had their sight fall through at Wallkill, New York, when the town fathers basically kicked them out, they did have someone come out of the woodwork, this fellow Elliot Tiber. Have you heard about him and the Taking Woodstock movie that's come out this summer from Ang Lee?
No, I have not.
Yeah, Ang Lee, the director, has a comedic, probably semi-fictionalized movie about Woodstock, and it centers around the story of Elliot Tiber, and we have that story in our book. Elliot caught wind through the newspaper of the Woodstock Festival needing a new site, and he happened to have as head of the Chamber of Commerce there in Bethel, he had a permit that allowed art and music festivals to happen. They'd never had anything big where they were, so he called up Michael Lang, one of the promoters of Woodstock, and said, "Hey, come check this out." Now, Elliot claims that he was the guy who introduced them to Max Yasgur, the dairy farmer, on whose 600-acre farm Woodstock eventually took place. But Michael Lang, we talked to him, and Michael said, no, you know, Elliot did bring us to the town of Bethel, and he did have the permit, but we had a real estate agent who introduced us to Max.
Mm-hmm. And Max was a little worried about what was going to happen there, but he, in some ways, is an unlikely supporter of all that was to happen here, but just a straightforward, honest kind of guy who said people have a right to have different opinions and to express themselves, and he became a real supporter of freedom, didn't he?
That's right. Yes, he became an overnight hero of the counterculture. When the local folk objected to him using his farmland for this invasion of hippies and threatened to boycott his dairy products and so on, he stuck his heels in and said, "Well, I think these young folks are doing no harm, and they're a great crowd of kids and so on." He went out and addressed the crowd, and he became a hero overnight. And a couple of years later, when he died, he was the only dairy farmer in history to have a full-page obituary in Rolling Stone magazine.
Isn't that something? We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests, too. They're the authors of a wonderful book. It's just filled with great pictures for those of you who are at Woodstock or lived during that time, or those of you who wonder what in the world happened during that time, be you grandparents or be you children of people who were there. It's Woodstock, 3 days that rocked the world. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm sure there are more than one person listening to us right now did attend Woodstock and may be interested in your reminiscences. Was it a transcendent moment for you, or was it kind of hard to slog your way through mud and the drugs that were there? What was it for you? We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Woodstock is what we're talking about this hour as we approach just in a couple days the 40th anniversary of Woodstock. Our guests, the authors of Woodstock, 3 days that rock the world. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The Vietnam War certainly was raging at that time. There were people who had already moved to Canada because their draft numbers were pretty low and they were about to be drafted. A lot of college students had done that. I knew people who went to Canada during those years. Tell me, was there a great deal of anti-war sentiment in the songs, in the demonstrations, in the feelings among the people who were at Woodstock?
Well, there certainly was in some of the songs. I mean, obviously, performers like Joan Baez, who was a specifically politically oriented singer anyway, she and her husband at the time was in jail for avoiding the draft. People like Country Joe McDonald, who came out with his Fixing to Die rag, which became a kind of anti-war anthem. Richie Havens with Freedom, and various other elements were anti-war oriented. But more importantly, I think that movement was a unifying factor within the crowd there, within young people generally in America at the time, in the face of the draft. If you remember that the average age of a GI in Vietnam was 19, so they were just, you know, hardly out of high school. It's incredible.
And Joan Baez, I didn't realize, was 6 months pregnant when she performed there, Paul.
Yeah, you know, and she did something that no other headlining act did at Woodstock, which was they had set up a little almost temporary stage outside the main area for, you know, originally they'd set it up for people who might not have tickets to get in. Of course, it immediately turned into a free festival and everybody who could get to the site got in. But there were people outside who were milling around, and Joan Baez went to this little ancillary stage and performed so long, were so generous a performer that her manager had to grab her at one point and say, "Don't you realize what's going on tonight? We've got to get you to the stage."
And she's still growing strong and looks fabulous, doesn't she, all these years?
She does.
She sure does. Let's go to some phone calls. We'll start with Rich from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I'm wondering if your authors in any way captured in their book the grimier side.
Oh, yeah.
Woodstock, because my story is I was living with some stoner friends at the time on Bassett Street in Madison, Wisconsin, and I was never a stoner. I had worse problems. I was what they called at the time a juicer, and that's all behind me now. But I lent a bunch of stuff to people who were going to Woodstock, sleeping bags and tents and other stuff. I had been drafted out of the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, and because I was a conscientious objector, a.k.a. a draft dodger, I was working on the north side of Lake Mendota at a facility for the developmentally disabled. And all these people around me were going off on this holiday, and I was trusting them with my stuff. they came back after the weekend with three burned sleeping bags, a couple of tents with holes in them, and they got really upset with me because I was the materialistic one.
Oh, what a story.
It was the weekend after which, for me, I started growing up in the 60s died, in much the way that I still love the music, but in much the way that, Joan Didion talks about the Sharon Tate Charles Manson case as the day of the 60s died. I began to draw sharp distinctions between people who were acquaintances, friends, and coworkers and neighbors and so on and so forth, because I just smirk at people these days who say they have 350 friends on Facebook or something like that. It was a weekend I missed and I was jealous of, and then when they returned with all my stuff trashed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of these situations where you woke up in the morning in the apartment and you never knew how many people were going to be sleeping on the floor and how many dogs were going to be there either. I mean, it was, but anyway, it was a wonderful time for them, and I still love the music, but I'm interested in the grimier side of this picture.
That's a great call. Thanks, Rich. Mike, you want to start?
Well, There's certainly aspects of the grimy side in the book, I'm glad to say. It's what we call warts and all. You know, there's lots of references to the almost impossible conditions that both the musicians and the audience labored under. Hence this whole feeling of community and self-help that emerged out of what was a mud bath. I mean, many of the people, witnesses, likened the scene to a medieval battlefield when the festival finished. And sadly, the one fatality was a guy still in his sleeping bag when bulldozers were clearing up all the sleeping bags that were rain-sodden and people just left them behind. And tragically, one guy was still in a sleeping bag when the bulldozers arrived. And that was the only fatality. And so I don't think we give a rosy picture of it, put it that way.
What about the drugs there? You know, it is amazing to me the number of people who were taking LSD, the number of performers who died shortly after this because of heroin overdoses, and they were stoned when they are on stage. And there are a lot of performers who say, well, we didn't give our best because there was rain and there were electrical problems and we were too high. That was also a big part of this, wasn't it?
Oh, well, yeah. The drug scene, well, I mean, it was part of that.
The Grateful Dead.
Well, we got what we had to do. I'm sorry, go ahead, Paul.
One of their worst gigs ever when they were playing because they were all stoned, and then they'd had rains before they played, and the stage was still wet, and their roadies hadn't set it up properly. So they were getting shocked by their equipment. They were getting shocked by their mics and guitars. You had other performers, though, who took drugs and performed just fine. You know, Carlos Santana admits that he was peaking on mescaline at the time, and yet, by all accounts, and you can see them playing in the Woodstock film, you know, Santana, which had been just an act known in the Bay Area, hadn't even had their first album come out, Santana were one of the hits for the festival.
Mm-hmm. Mike?
I think the Janis Joplin story is quite interesting.
Yes.
Because she was due to go on at, I don't know, 8 o'clock or something, and because of the huge backlog and delay on everything, by the time it got to Janis's set, she went on at 12 o'clock at night. You know, it was that late. And, of course, by which time she'd drank a couple of bottles of Jack Daniels, which normally she'd do after the gig.
Right.
So, in fact, she went on pretty drunk. And, as I say, on this whole time delay and the chaos didn't help any of that, because people were just hanging around backstage waiting to go on, you know, and nothing better to do than smoke a joint or drink a drink, I guess. And, of course, that whole culture was, drugs was part of that culture, that counterculture. It's no good pretending it wasn't. And even if Woodstock hadn't occurred, a lot of the participants would have, over that weekend, taken some drugs. I mean,
right.
It would have happened anyway. I mean, it was happening in England, and we were, you know, the other side of the ocean, but it was part of that culture. It didn't begin and end with Woodstock.
Why was it so big a part of the culture?
I think it was so early in let's say, our modern culture's experience with drugs. You know, marijuana was just getting popularized across countries like England and the United States in a way that had never been popularly cultivated in Western civilization. But LSD had only recently been synthesized and widely used, and I think it was very experimental. There was a sense of let's expand our consciousness, let's see where we can go with this. You know, we've had alcohol for a long time. We've tried that. We know how to use that. Let's see what these other things do. It's only, you know, in the decades since that we've begun to realize the terrible toll some of these things can take.
Right.
That's right. It was very experimental because, I mean, I was around at that time as a musician, and so I was very aware and participated in a lot of that scene. You know, I wasn't a drug addict by any means, but one experimented with all these things. And as Paul said, it was very early days. I mean, LSD had only been invented, if that's the right word, a few years before, and via Timothy Leary and so on, became popularized and publicized, but it was still very much an unknown quantity. And it was only maybe a decade later that the real possible dangers of it started to be proven.
Right.
Likewise with marijuana, it being part of sort of underground jazz culture and beatnik culture, but it didn't enter the popular mainstream consciousness until that latter half of the 60s.
Let's go to Joanne from Madison. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. Great show. I'm going to be going to Woodstock this weekend for an academic-style a conference on the peace economy, and I'm wondering why there wasn't a more musically-oriented conference. Collaboration arranged to commemorate the 40th anniversary. Why whatever they tried to get started fell through, or if you've got some of the backstory on that.
Why are you going to a conference instead of a musical festival, right? Yeah, or go to both.
Well, yes, this is a very extraordinary conference. Jeremy Scahill is going to be there, a number of people speaking.
Sounds good. What? Why nothing there, Paul?
Well, I know that Michael Lang and Joel Rosenman, two of the original four promoters who cooked up and made Woodstock happen, all along over the past several months, they've been trying to come to agreement about what could be done around Woodstock. But they haven't worked together for a long time, and they're not used to working with each other. They live different lives now. So they could never really come together on what could be done. But also, we live in a different world now. There are a number of commemorative events happening around Woodstock, and there's the Heroes of Woodstock tour going on that's going to be at Bethel this coming weekend. But in terms of actually recreating Woodstock again, I feel the moment has passed. They tried to do it in 94. They did a fairly good job with some of the original Woodstock performers and newer acts. Then they did it in 99, and it didn't work out well. In fact, there was rioting among the audience, and they set things afire. I don't know that you can really recapture Woodstock again. Mike, how would you answer this?
Well, I don't think you could recapture the essence of the event, because, as I said to somebody on a UK radio show this morning, how do you recreate chaos? It's in terms, and part of the magic of Woodstock, if magic is the right word, or sort of part of the phenomenon, was the chaos, and what came out of that chaos, which was this event that was much more than just the music. But going back to the current weekend, the museum at Bethel Woods, where there's the kind of Woodstock Commemoration Museum, which overlooks the site, the original site, they are having a weekend of small events. But Woodstock itself, of course, is 40 miles north of there. And as your caller said, I guess there's not much happening in Woodstock itself, because that was never eventually the actual site of the festival.
Right. In a way, to me, I was struck. I was watching the news last night, and they had an interview with the couple who are immortalized in the photo. It's in your book as well, the young people who are on the front of the album. And they're married, and they've been married for years and years and years, and they had them with their children, I think four children, living in a beautiful spot in New England, and reminiscing fondly about that particular weekend. And I thought, we can remember it, but it's over. And people who were there are in their 50s or in their 60s, and it's a memory for them, but move on. That's over now. It's their children. It's that generation we need to make way for, which makes me think you can't recreate it now, because the people are starting to become elderly, right?
Well, that's right. I was part of that, as I say, I was part of that generation and that scene. And I've now got three grandchildren,
It's hard to believe, right?
it's what we're commemorating in the book. It's a point in history which is fascinating in itself, but one wouldn't expect it to be repeated.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking about Woodstock this hour of the program, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our guests are the authors of Woodstock, 3 Days That Rocked the World.
Didn't I give another everything that I ever had to give? Oh, you know I did. Well, each time I tell my baby, I think I've had enough of it. I'm gonna show you, baby, that a woman can be tough. Well, you take hormones, 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 hormones. You take it. Take another little piece of my heart, no, baby. Take another little piece of my heart, but darling, yeah, 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 yeah. Have another little piece of my heart, daddy, daddy, daddy.
Janis Joplin and Take Another Piece of My Heart. We've already told her story. Some of it, we'll get back to Janis Joplin. June is our next caller from Toronto. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen. She sounded pretty good on that record.
Yeah, she did.
I just wanted, when I heard Rich call, it took me back to that period when I was in Madison and had finished my orals. And strangely enough, one of my roommates, who was going to join her husband in Canada, volunteered at the same organization where Rich was working.
Oh, my gosh.
Such a small world.
It is a small world.
I was in London at the time of Woodstock, and my friends, staying with friends, and on my way to home in Lagos, and was very excited about, they had very excited about Jimi Hendrix, and of course he was in the U.S., but they took me to a club there to satiate some of my need for music. And incidentally, when Santana played in Madison some many years later, my husband and I took our son to his concert. So it all brings back terrific memories.
Hmm. Thank you so much for the call. Any comments, Mike Paul?
I don't have any, Mike.
Okay.
Well, as I say, it is generational. This music, it's very interesting that 40 years later, it's not just granddad's music. A lot of young people are still fascinated by Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Santana, and a lot of these musicians and bands are still on the road, and they, you know, they're in their late 60s, some of them, you know, and they're still on the road.
They sure are. It's unbelievable, isn't it? It's just, it takes so much energy, I think, to do a concert, and they're still going strong.
Yeah, because, I mean, I in the course of doing the book, I spoke at length to Joe Cocker, who, of course, is from the north of England, as I am, and he'd just come off a world tour. He'd just come off 15 months on the road, and he's in his mid-60s, yeah.
Let's go next to Garrett from Green Bay. Hi, Garrett.
Hey, I'm just calling to let you know that I'm a hippie wannabe from the 80s. I'm 40 years old. I missed the Woodstock thing, but a lot of my family went, and most of the people I know that did go went with little to no money, just enough to basically get there. And what they tell me they remember most about Woodstock is the getting there and the going home. Everything else was pretty much a blur. But they do say that it was the best time in their life, and they were well taken care of, even though they had no money, and they had enough money to go back home and some drugs in their pocket. But so that's my story, and I'll take the response off air. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Paul.
You know, I think that just confirms what we were talking about earlier, about that, you know, there was that kind of communal spirit at Woodstock. People were taken care of. You know, there's that famous scene where Wavy Gravy of the Hog Farmer says, you know, what we have in mind here this morning is breakfast in bed for $400,000.
Right.
And, you know, they actually catered to everybody.
Right. Tell me about the emergency measures, well, the measures that needed to be taken in order to feed everybody. There had to be food flown in. There were some interesting responses from nuns and religious organizations who helped deal with this great need of this huge community that was there.
That's right. Once it became apparent that there was a serious crisis, they had a serious crisis on their hands. On the one hand, the hog farmers and the other sort of hippie commune type groups helped the distribution of as much food as they could, and they went out to the neighboring areas and got food in. And at the same time, the local population, who originally a lot of them were probably anti the whole idea. Once this crisis looked like it was emerging, they came in with sandwiches and food, and the local medics came in to help with the any medical problems, accidents that would inevitably happen, and drug problems and so on. And it was a whole pulling together. And as I say, even the local community who were perhaps anti a lot of the aspects of it to start with, came in, and as you said, there were local nuns and local Jewish groups making sandwiches and making supplies available, and the whole thing came together in an amazing way. And by the end of the 3 days, I think there was a lot more peace and love, if you like, to use the corny old phrase, than there was when it started.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about Woodstock this hour of the program, and our guests are the co-authors of Woodstock, 3 days that rocked the world. Our phone number, our lines are busy, but keep it in mind, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. We go to Carol from Poinette. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Let me turn the radio down here.
Okay.
I have kind of an interesting story. I actually was born the year Woodstock took place. However, the story pertains to my grandfather. He lived about 2 miles away from the concert.
Oh.
And what makes it kind of humorous is, you know, he was a German immigrant in the 30s. And so he had this farm near Narrowsburg in Monticello, not too far from Bethel, where he lived, farmed most of his life, and just enjoyed the complete solitude. One day after college, or one time after college, I was traveling in the area to visit him. And my traveling companion and I were taking a road trip. While we were visiting and driving down the country roads, and we see this sign, and it says Woodstock and an arrow, and I look at her, and I said, "Is that what I think it is?" And so we took a drive down there, and sure enough, it was unreal. You know, we would never have guessed it was a place of a concert, except for the monument being there. So the next day at breakfast, I said to my grandfather, "You'll never guess what we ran across," and I mentioned Woodstock, and my grandmother kind of gets a big smile on her face and starts looking around the room like, oh, no, she's getting Walter started on the subject. And he was, you know, his perspective on it was kind of humorous, but perhaps not to him. He said it was probably the most ridiculous thing you could ever imagine, and of course all of this is in his thick German accent, that they would go weeks before they would see another human being go down the road in a car, basically. And he said there were so many people there. People were just parked along the road for miles and miles and miles away. His whole country road on both sides of the road were parked just from wherever your eye could see. And he said one day they had happened to notice his pond across the street from his house, and had proceeded to go down there. There was a group, I would say about 20 or 30, to skinny dip in his pond. And he was outraged at the audacity. So consequently, a few rounds of .22 being fired off into the air.
Oh, my gosh.
The area.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yes, just to kind of show you just how fiery of a person he was.
I guess. Thanks, Carol, for the call. There was a lot of skinny dipping. Skinny dipping was big in the 60s. At least it was a part of Woodstock, certainly, wasn't it? And people just needed to get cooled off or get clean, too.
Well, that's right. One of the photographers we interviewed who claimed to have actually kicked the skinny dipping off. He initiated it, so he claims. He said that the reason that the kids did it, by and large, is for totally practical reasons, that they were in the mud, and then when the rain finished, the sun shone, and the mud caked dry, and they were just filthy dirty. And the only way of getting rid of this was jump in the water, you know, and that was it.
And there was somebody from Playboy. That's an interesting little story. He was asked to bring back pictures, I guess, of certain parts of naked bodies.
That's right. Guy called...
Wasn't that Roland?
Roland Sherman, that's right. He'd done some work for Playboy, and when he read about the festival, he thought, "Well, I'd like to go there, but I'd like to go as part of the photographer journalistic community and get close to the stage and so on, rather than just part of the crowd." So he phoned up Playboy and said, "Hey, there's this big festival happening upstate. Could you give me a free pass with, you know, press pass with Playboy written on it?" And they said, "Well, we're not interested in that kind of thing, but sure, use a pass, come and get a pass, you know." So they gave him a pass, and they didn't want to know about the festival because they weren't a music magazine. Anyway, he went up there and took pictures of the bands and so on. And when he came back, of course, there'd been all this publicity, including the skinny dipping and the nudity. And Playboy rang him up and said, "You know, where's the nude pictures? Where's the nude pictures?"
Right.
He said, "I didn't take any." They said, "That's no good."
Of all places to not take the pictures. Here's an email from Jim from Madison. The original movie Woodstock showed great action, captured the intensity of the performers. He loved Santana's soul sacrifice. His question is, the original movie was pared down and showed just a sampling of what went on. I imagine that the promoters recorded all the performances. Has there been any effort to offer the entire Woodstock music on DVD? I mean the nonstop action.
Well, there's a new DVD just ended up.
You know, originally there were a couple of reasons why all the acts didn't appear in the Woodstock film. One was that, you know, everything was so haphazard with getting the film together. It wasn't until the very last moment of the festival getting started that they actually had the green light from Warner Brothers Pictures to go ahead and fund this thing and film it. And as a result, they didn't have releases in place for all the, you know, film releases for all the artists.
Oh, my.
And many of the artists, you know, for instance, the band with their powerful manager, Albert Grossman, who's the manager of Bob Dylan, you know, they just refused. You know, John Fogerty and Creedence Clearwater, they refused to be in the film. Several acts refused to be in the film. And it was purely a licensing issue. You know, it was about money. And, Mike, do you know where it stands with almost every act was filmed? There were some technical difficulties with some, I know, but have they actually reached the point where most of them are available?
I don't know, but there's this new DVD release just been released now, as you know, which covers a lot more of the music than it did on the original film. They've inserted about 35 new songs going across the festival. So the new DVD is a much more expanded version than the originally released film. However much more film there is in the vaults, which can't be released for copyright reasons or whatever, I don't know.
Yeah. Woodstock, 40 years later, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I will try not to sing out of key. Oh, baby, have it back.
Joe Cocker with a Beatles song with a little help from my friends. There were some attempts, weren't there, Mike, to get the Beatles to come to Woodstock?
Yeah, they approached the Beatles, but the Beatles turned it down. I can understand why, because they hadn't appeared in a live concert since 1966 in San Francisco. So I guess apart from that famous thing on the roof in their offices in London, but they hadn't appeared in an audience situation for 3 years. So they weren't really prepared for that kind of thing. And it was a period when they were on the point of breaking up. So I guess the chances of getting the Beatles were pretty slim anyway.
Right. Let's go to Bruce from Lamira. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I'm wondering if you guys could speak very quickly to the business aspect. You mentioned Dylan went to the Isle of Wight concert. After the Isle of Wight concert, there was a big concert in Rotterdam, which I attended as a college student traveling Europe. And a lot of those guys performed at that concert. Were these all individual promoters?
They were all promoted by different individuals. You know, the Woodstock Ventures group, four young promoters in their 20s put on that one. It's a completely different group that put on Isle of Wight, and I'm guessing the Rotterdam Festival would have been someone separate from the Isle of Wight, right, Mike?
Quite.
What did you say, Mike? Quite?
Yes, quite.
Oh, okay.
They're quite separate sort of promoters of these events, yeah.
Okay.
Are all these guys young promoters, or are they professionals out of Hollywood, or...?
Well, certainly, the Woodstock guys were young promoters. Michael Lang was in his early 20s. I played at the Isle of Wight the day that Bob Dylan was on, actually.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and the promoters there were two young guys, two local guys who they'd done a festival in 68 the year before, and that was pretty good. Jefferson Airplane were the headliners, and it went so well that they went for the big one and offered Dylan a fee, which I suspect was about twice the fee that Woodstock had offered him, and he chose the Isle of Wight. But I played on the same day, yeah.
Oh, that was quite a memory, huh?
Well, that was kind of Britain's Woodstock, really. It was about a quarter of a million there. It was a big event.
Yeah. Thanks, Bruce, for the call. Joan from Williams Bay is next. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I didn't hear anything about youth finding his voice at Woodstock, and music expressed their joy in being heard. They couldn't accept that they were fighting our war, and they couldn't drink. They're not old enough to drink, but they're old enough to fight our war. And they found a lot of other things to cry out about, and that happened at Woodstock and began the movement that we listen to now, and that's our youth. And I don't know if you cover that in Woodstock.
Yeah, thanks. And you do when you look at what was happening with young people. That's an interesting comment, Joan. Paul, you want to take that on?
Well, I think I agree with what Joan said, and we definitely do tell that story in this book. As you were alluding to much earlier in our interview, Kathleen, you know, the way this book is structured, it's structured in three parts, and we have a whole beginning section about the threads, the musical threads, the social threads that led to the great gathering at Woodstock, including strong sections on the war, the protest movement, student unrest. And as Mike was saying earlier in this interview today, you know, many of the performers had songs that were very much protest and against the Vietnam War. You know, Joan Baez and Country Joe McDonald, you know, on down the line, there were many songs of protest there. And, you know, certainly the peace symbol was all over Woodstock, and the anti-war movement was a great gathering point for people at Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most poignant point in the festival, which encompassed this sort of patriotism, this love of America, but this absolute anger about the Vietnam War, came with Jimi Hendrix and the Star Spangled Banner, because playing the national anthem, not criticizing the national anthem or devaluing it, but playing it in that fashion with that anger, really was a bit like the peace symbol appearing on so many stars and stripes at the festival. It was a love of America, but a hate of that war.
Right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. It's a wonderful book, and I can't believe all this was 40 years ago. Life just goes too fast, doesn't it? That's my take on
this. Well, we try to capture it in books when we can.
I know. And then look at the pictures over and over. Thank you so much. It was a great, great time.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you. Our guests are the co-authors of Woodstock, 3 days that shook... rather, that rocked the world. And they are Mike Evans, a musician on the 60s rock scene, who began writing about popular music in the 1970s, Paul Kingsbury, a writer and editor specializing in music and the environment. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Carmen Jackson for producing the program. Thanks to Jolema Noel for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you for listening, everybody.